So I'll mainly be talking about sex with aliens by means of getting to that topic, so let's get right to it. This is Antonio Villas-Lobos, Argentinian farmer, and in 1961 he was abducted apparently by the lizard men, according to this cartoon, from the cartoon Johnny Quest. The Johnny Quest version is actually a lot dirtier than the real abduction. So he was taken on board the alien spaceship, where he was apparently confronted by the GIMP, and then a small blonde woman approached him and aroused him several times, then with gestures indicated that the union of their love would be a star baby, and he was released back into the wild to carry on his life. And aside from a little bit of radiation sickness, he was totally fine, lived the rest of his life without any trouble. So this guy, a French astrophysicist and computer scientist, Jacques Vallée, looked at these experiences and tried to come up with an explanation. He looked at contactee and abductee accounts and tried to understand what was going on from a scientific perspective. And as opposed to the other people in the scientific community he was working with, he decided to actually take their accounts at face value and then compare them to previous accounts in history. So he looked back through folklore, religious revelation, contact little people, and saw a lot of commonalities in all of their experiences. So he realized this only made sense from a scientific perspective if they were describing essentially the same human phenomena. So in order to really explain how this works, we're going to have to start at the beginning, namely Genesis. I should also mention at this point I'm not going to have time for questions. So in Genesis 6:4, there's this passage which has provoked a lot of theological debate. Apparently the sons of God did things to the women of earth, and apparently it looked something like this, according to my analysis of relevant scripture and Talmudic scholarship. I think that's actually Noah in the diaper. These offspring of this unholy union, or holy union, depending on your perspective, were the Nephilim, and I've also further analyzed Talmudic accounts. They differ, but they could have looked like this, or perhaps like this. They're said to have very large bones. They were very naughty, and they may have been family-oriented, but they were demonic, some kind of otherworldly demonic being. But this is the Holy Bible we're talking about. This is actual reality. This is all true. So there are also many other interesting contactee accounts in the holy scriptural truth, such as burning bushes, strange voices telling you to kill your son. This is, of course, the wheels of Ezekiel. You're all familiar with this. Let's get a little closer so it makes a lot more sense. We also have some data visualization. This is the wheels of Ezekiel in 3D, and this is a steampunk rendering of the wheels of Ezekiel. Clearly, this is true. All of this is true. Now, in terms of Orthodox religious experience, contacting non-human entities, they tend to be virginal, pure, even when they sound exactly like a UFO abductee account. For example, the Virgin of Guadalupe, which is not the Virgin Mary. It's actually a completely separate entity who was a native woman who met this guy, Juan Diego, in the 16th century in Mexico. This ended up becoming the patron saint of Mexico, but for nearly a century after this experience, the Orthodox Catholic Church was trying to stamp it out because it appeared to be simply a cover for the worship of an Aztec goddess. And there is, of course, the Virgin of Fatima. These Portuguese children, who are here rendered as small German children in the hills of Switzerland, saw, along with 70,000 other people, the sun dancing in the sky, lights falling from the sky, spinning around, and so they're like, oh, well, clearly that's the Virgin. So everybody in Portugal, there were three separate occurrences of this vision. By the final one, basically everybody in Portugal in 1917 was outside going, what's the sun? Like, again, this was purified, and so it became a vision of the Virgin. But even though it looked in all other respects like a crazy, insane UFO contactee experience, this was able to be reincorporated into the Orthodox faith. Another example of this happening where it was totally pure, nothing going on here. This is the origin of the Mormon religion, where the angel Moroni visits Joseph Smith in his bedroom, and nothing impure could happen when an angel in a robe appears in a young man's bedroom. And he appeared, according to the account in the front of the scripture of the Latter-day Saints, he appeared in his bedroom 3 times, delivered a cryptic message about digging up gold plates and some kind of lizard, and that he had to do this or else, and then repeated. This is actually the basis of their faith. This is actually an actual image of what happened in the bedroom. You can see that the only difference between the South Park version is that the real angel has much better hair. So, again, this is totally bizarre, but it's been made chaste and made orthodox and becomes the foundation of the fastest growing religion in the world right now. Now, according to the rest of folklore, these accounts are happening all over the place, but they are not nearly so chaste, and they're much stranger. So in folklore and heterodox spirituality, there are contact accounts which are dirty, perverse, and weird. And so these are the original fairy tales, literally fairy tales, where there's nasty contact with these non-human entities, all sorts of abductions and rape and lost time and mysticism and strange states of consciousness, little people with their own weird little culture, and we don't really know what they're trying to say to us, but they're trying to say something to us urgently, and this communication keeps happening, but it makes no sense. So Jacques Vallée, French astrophysicist, he tried to figure out what was going on and tried to analyze all these accounts in a logical, scientific, astrophysical kind of information science-y way, but they just made no sense. There was too much bizarre... Nothing connected, nothing actually pointed back to a single logical explanation. And one example is the story of the pancake story, actually, where a woman... Oh, it's a sad story. A woman sent off to the baker. She wants some bread. And the baker came back with the bread and a fancy pancake. And I didn't ask for a fancy pancake, said the woman. And the baker said, no, well, you would only order today, so it must be your fancy pancake. It may have looked like this. It may have looked like this. It could have even looked like this. But we know that she did eat the fancy pancake, free pancake. So later that evening, in her bedroom, an entity appeared. Hey, baby. This is the fairy prince, of course. How you like my pancake? And the fairy prince had wandering hands, trying to seduce the woman. I gave you a fancy pancake. You liked it. You ate it, didn't you? Come on, baby. But she is a good woman, so she resists the seduction. But it keeps up night after night. Hey, baby, don't play me like that. You ate my fancy pancake. Now give me a little something. So she resists. She is a good, holy, virginal woman. And it goes on like this for weeks. No, really, you ate my fairy pancake, now we have sex, come on. So it gets worse and worse. Eventually there are poltergeist events, chairs are being thrown about the house, dishes are broken, then they're reformed. Oh, I'm being crazy with you, look, now you gotta have sex with me because things are weird, whoa. So she called in the exorcist, but the elf still wanted to bone. So the fairy starts getting really mad. He takes the baby and dangles it from the roof, off the awning, trying to frighten the woman into having sex with him. So he steals jewelry, he hides her Pope trinkets. Eventually there's the whole poltergeist bit going on. So this is the sort of account that is common in actual fairy tales. When we look at folklore and when you sort of break down the pure veneer over Orthodox religiosity, these are the kind of stories that seem to be happening all the time throughout human history. Now, this guy tried to sanitize all this. This was, of course, you recognize William Butler Yeats. He popularized a romantic sanitary version of folklore and fairy tales. So there were lots of innocent people romping in field and glen, singing innocent songs, eating delicious baked goods that in no way ensnare you to a sexual predator, totally innocent. So interestingly, in his personal life, Yeats was directly involved with this whole non-human contact thing. He was actually in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, an organization of ceremonial musicians who tried to contact angels, demons, spiritual elementals, and such like. So while Yeats was in the Golden Dawn, writing about nice fairies but trying to contact the bad fairies, he met this sassy young lad who joined up. He became a central figure of the Hermetic movement of the 20th century. This is Aleister Crowley, here before the heroine. And he was a bright, ambitious, egomaniacal young lad and a very dirty boy. So after 2 years, Yeats, who wanted to preserve his romantic vision of fairydom, didn't want to disrupt it by Crowley's version of fairies, had Crowley kicked out of the Golden Dawn. So Crowley struck out on his own. He did some magic. He climbed some mountains. He took a lot of drugs. And then his wife while they were inside the Great Pyramid, channeled an unearthly entity called Iwas, and this entity dictated the Book of the Law to him, which became the basis for the Ordo Templi Orientis and his own magical tradition, including the A Astrum Argentum. Actually, no one knows what it means. It's a secret. So Crowley described a system of magic, and to distinguish it from stage magic, he added, okay, so it's magic. And this form of magic was developed around the concept of thelema, the Greek word for will. So the idea that you could connect things at will, and by means of making those connections to different concepts symbolically, you would gain power over the world. And the basis of this faith or system was do what thou wilt, the whole of the law, which interestingly relates to the sociological concept of anomy, which is lawlessness or the removal of all norms. And that's how we got Burning Man. So he was a drug addict, a semi-closeted homosexual philanderer, built himself as the Antichrist and the wickedest man alive, which brought us all sorts of modern innovations in ideology, the snake of evil. And this idea of do what thou wilt and the release from all norms, well, let me go off on a tangent here. The 20th century occult tradition has become a symbolic system, sort of a meta system describing some sort of outsiderdom that doesn't necessarily have any content. So it became a sort of ritual for people to prove their connection to this anomic culture by just having their picture taken with a Satanist. So this, you may recognize, he's evil too. But this is interesting. This is actually the UFO researcher Amy Michel, and this is Jacques Vallée. Not sure what that means. So back on topic. All this is plenty sexy, obviously, but what does it have to do with science fiction and the origins of modern rocketry? So to explain, we have to go to Pasadena. Beautiful conservative Pasadena, old money Pasadena, peaceful. It's about a half a mile from lovely Pasadena City Hall, where there was a mansion on 1003 South Orange Grove, owned by this fellow. This is John Jack Parsons. He was one of the founders of the Jet Propulsion Lab. He basically was just really into blowing shit up and was good at it in kind of an alchemical way. Didn't actually have a scientific degree, but was really good at mixing explosives in unique ways. Hooked up with some grad students from Caltech, and this was where they started modern rocket science in Arroyo out in back of Pasadena. And this moment where they were just blowing things up until they actually got rockets to work is memorialized every year at Caltech. They actually put the Jack Parsons mannequin out there and have the pretend thing. They didn't do his beard, interestingly. I'm not sure if there's an occult meaning behind that. So this is actually still a ritualized encounter with the body of Jack Parsons. In Jack Parsons' early years, while he was developing his urge to blow things up, he actually followed and contact with the German rocket scientist Wernher von Braun, who, as I'm sure you all know, was brought to America in Operation Paperclip, and here he is with Walt Disney showing off their black budget defense projects. Now, the Americans wanted to get a hold of any German aerospace technology, such as this real flying saucer, the Vril craft, and of course von Braun became a respected member of the American Aerospace and Defense Program. Walt Disney did not fare so well. But what about Jack Parsons? Jack Parsons was a bad boy. He was a rebel. He scorns the shirt wearing of the normals. He puts your morality in his pipe and he smokes it. Parsons got hooked up with the proto-magic beatnik scene of the 1940s and led the Pasadena Agape Lodge of Crowley's Ordo Templi Orientis. So there were some infamous doings down there on Orange Grove Lane. He called himself the heir of Baphomet, beast of the new eon, signified by the Kabbalistic number 210, Jacob Bell Antichrist. And he had national security clearances so that he could work on what was at the time the most advanced aerospace technology that we had. And the feds were a tad bit nervous about having a major technology developed by a ceremonial magician and various bohemian naughty people. So a religious cult with sexual perversion. So there's a lot of details to cover in terms of what happened in South Orange Grove, so I have some diagrams to assist us with the social relationships. This is Jack. And Jack met Helen in Pasadena, a nice, normal relationship. He just liked to blow things up. A nice girl, they got married. So Jack discovers the Ordo Templi Orientis. He becomes an amoral wizard, fashions himself the Antichrist, and commences to have sex rituals all about the house and grounds. Helen's all like, oh, no. So at that point, Jack takes note of Helen's teenage sister. Helen is out. So Jack and Helen, Sarah, the teenager, a.k.a. Betty, get together and rituals are performed. At this point, on the scene arrives a young Navy officer, L. Ron Hubbard. He's fresh out of the Navy on a mental health discharge. So he's free of the man now, and he's ready to build a name for himself in the sci-fi scene. So with a passing knowledge of ritual magic and a complete sociopathic personality, he arrives at Orange Grove Lane, a bohemian sex magic house. And there were some significant rituals, let me tell you. Now, there was also sharing. Jack is a benevolent antichrist, so they had various rituals in various combinations. But they were also interested in ushering in the new eon, the era of the antichrist, and and giving birth to a moon child, which would actually be the end of Orthodox Christianity. So by way of explaining what these rituals were like, it's obviously ceremony magic. I've, again, created some diagrams to make this a little more clear, cut through some of the jargon. This is a rough approximation of what was going on in the 1940s in Pasadena, where this is actually the backyard of the Bush family, the beer heirs. And so you can see that it's a little complicated. And so people were trying to usher in the new eon with a variety of rituals. And in one particular climactic ritual in the desert where they were trying to contact Venusians, apparently it worked. And they decided, oh, but we have succeeded. When they came home, the Scarlet Woman was waiting for them. Marjorie Cameron, Candida, some called her Candy. Oh, look what we made. So they were very happy about the Whore of Babylon having arrived at their mansion, declared her the consort of the beast, vessel of the Antichrist, and she was totally into it. So they proceeded to have many more rituals. At some point, the Whore of Babylon had some stuff to do, had to take off, see you guys later. but they were still sharing until L. Ron, who was not quite as sharing a person, took off with Betty and Jack's money that they had invested in attempting to buy yachts and sail them through the Panama Canal for a markup. So Jack pursued them to Florida, but they had already taken off on the yacht. And so he called down a storm from a nearby hotel room, and it worked. So they were forced to return to shore. There was a lawsuit. They didn't really hang out that much after that. So Hubbard, in later years, claimed that he'd only been spying on the nasty sex cult as a spy. Crowley had actually been grooming Jack Parsons as the head of the American branch of his order, but after seeing him get suckered by L. Ron Hubbard, he decided maybe this isn't really the Antichrist. So a few years later, Jack remains in contact with Marjorie, and they eventually get married. So everything is going along very nicely. They're sort of a magical couple. They're about to go on a magical trip to Mexico, and then Jack gets blowed up. Aren't quite sure what happens. Maybe he dropped the mercury fulminate. Maybe the cop bomber that he put in jail decided to hide explosives in the trash can. Maybe the whole Antichrist thing was just too powerful. In any case, that's it for Jack. So Marjorie, however, apparently they picked a winner. She stays on the freak scene as it slowly takes over the entire West Coast, and she lives a long, freaky life. So she hooks up with a crowd of magician bikers in Malibu. She's in some Kenneth Anger films, sort of same general scene as Manson and various other cults and occultists. Whole other story, though. So let's focus back in on Pasadena of the 1940s and 50s. This is actually Southern California in the late 40s. You'll notice the extensive public transportation network. Few people remember that the red car was actually pterodactyl-powered. It's true. So at the time of the 40s and 50s, the pulps and science fiction magazines were a major part of culture. So Parsons was an avid science fiction fan, and at the time, L. Ron Hubbard was among the best-known pulp authors in America. So some of the people in this particular social circle at the Pasadena Mansion included Forrest J. Ackerman, who ran the LA Science Fiction Society, where Jack Parsons also met Ray Bradbury. And Ray Bradbury said about Jack Parsons that he was fascinated by his ideas about the future, which I believe is a standard response when one of your avid fans is a black magician. Also hang around in this group, Jack Williamson, and Parsons was particularly fascinated by one of his stories that described an ancient race trying to regain power over men by the birth of a magical child. A.E. Van Vogt, Robert Heinlein, and some have suggested that Robert Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land was based on the ideology of Jack Parsons. Another thing that was happening in the late 40s in the pulps was called the Shaver Mystery. And this isn't much talked about these days, but it's actually one of the biggest things to happen at the time culturally. And 1947 is huge. And it was mainly because of this guy, Ray Palmer, who was the editor of Amazing Stories. And around 1946, he heard one of the other editors crump up a letter and say something about, "Ah, you crazy people," and throw something in the trash. So he ran over and got the letter out of the trash, and it turned out to be a letter of a crazy person named Richard Shaver, who described a race of evil perverted dwarves, the remnants of a past civilization who went underground to hide from the Holocaust rays. But the Holocaust rays still affected their brains. They became stupid, weird perverts, but they still have all this high technology, so they would hide underground and then use their amazing tools to do things like make milk go bad or abduct women and torture them underground. Richard Shaver found all of this out because he got the transmissions through his welding machine while he was working in an auto plant. So Ray Palmer, seeing a good thing when he sees one, publishes the entire thing, actually edits it, expands it to three times its length to an even more lurid sex torture story, I Remember Lemuria. And he portrayed it as a true account by this guy, the guy who dug out of the trash. So perhaps because it was a true account, or perhaps because of other mythological forces, these stories were extremely popular, and circulation skyrocketed. Thousands of people wrote in to describe their own horrible experience at the hands of evil subterranean pervert dwarves. And this is a little strange because Ray Palmer actually was 4 feet tall due to an accident in childhood. So as he's describing these pervert dwarves taking over the world from underground, it's sort of a meta thing going on. So in June of 1947, the Shaver Mystery was at its peak. The circulation of Amazing Stories was now in the hundreds of thousands, going up from like a 10,000 circulation pulp magazine. And this entire issue was dedicated to people talking about the pervert dwarves who were messing up their lives. So it became this extensive paranoid mythology of technology beneath our feet that we couldn't begin to comprehend. In 1948, Ray Palmer was abruptly fired from Amazing Stories, and they went back to science fiction. L. Ron Hubbard decided that he would use the power of his science fiction brain to come up with a brand new system of belief. And his son, L. Ron Hubbard Jr., name changed to protect him, said that he actually heard his father say when Aleister Crowley died in 1947 that was when he decided to take over the mantle of being the Beast and to begin Scientology and Dianetics, which he began in a pulp magazine, Astounding Science Fiction, May 1950. Dianetics, A Science of the Mind, also this awesome, all-seeing belt buckle. Oh. So that pulp fiction story evolved into a book, which very quickly became a globe-spanning cult. And now we have the movie business. And it should be noted in this context that A.E. Van Vogt became the head of the Los Angeles Dianetics Foundation. This is him in the 70s, ready to boogie with some Scientologists. At the same time this was happening, that we had the Shaver Mystery, the underground dwarves, Dianetics becoming a religion, the UFO phenomena as a modern phenomena began in June of 1947. This guy was the start of the modern UFO. This is Kenneth Arnold, stalwart, reliable fellow, looking for a crashed airplane. He saw some 9 skipping discs. Someone on the AP wire called them flying saucers, and then he spent the rest of his life pointing at a flying saucer. Also, interesting that after Ray Palmer got fired from Amazing Stories, he started a new magazine, Fate, and the first issue featured Kenneth Arnold and the flying saucers. So this became the origin of people imagining contact with some sort of extraterrestrial other. And paranoia about this has been crystallized around Roswell. This is Roswell, sleepy little New Mexico town, not really near any highways, old-timey Roswell. Something actually fell out of the sky in 1947. Whatever else happened in Roswell, there's complete agreement that something physical fell out of the sky. And at one point, they were like, oh, we totally got a flying saucer, check it out. And then the next day, they said, no, it was a weather balloon, or just some twigs, or maybe foil. Look, it's a pot pie. It's nothing. It's, you know, don't worry about it. Move along. So this became the mythologization of conspiracy and cover-up, the idea that we couldn't actually figure out what was being said to us, even though communication was happening. And part of the mythology was that there was communication on the debris at Roswell, and there were bodies. Why? What were the bodies trying to do? Did the aliens actually fly here in a little metal ship and then get hit by a lightning bolt after crossing the cosmos, and then they die? What kind of aliens are these? What are they trying to say? But one of the main things about Roswell is that the object, the actual physical object that fell out of an epistemological field of knowability. So in a biblical sense, it's a fallen object. It has become an agent of disruption and chaos, evil. So aside from the interesting theological and philosophical issues about this fallen object, the government had some practical concerns about this whole unidentified flying thing. And this was the beginning of Cold War paranoia, facing for the first time the prospect of total human annihilation. So the site where whatever fell at Roswell happened was, although it seems out of the way, at the time, Roswell housed the only nuclear bomber group in the world that was ready to launch. So the only place where nuclear bombs could have been launched on a moment's notice was at Roswell Army Airfield. Also in New Mexico in 1947, Los Alamos Labs, Sandia Labs, White Sands Missile Test Range, and the Trinity Test Site for the first atomic bomb. So in 1947, New Mexico was the center of nuclear weapons technology, and Roswell was the nexus of this, the point where Holocaust would have began, and something, no one knows exactly what, no one has any evidence exactly what fell out of the sky. So when this happened, there were other incidents happening at the same time. There were things seen zipping around on radar near Washington, D.C., and this was known as the Battle of Washington. It was later blamed on swamp gas, and this became another sort of joke in the UFO community about how to cover something up with something that sounds sort of ludicrous. And all this tied into a mythology of an outside invader, some sort of mysterious threatening technology that was combined with the actual existence of an ideologically opposed superpower. So this paranoid mythology grew to massive proportions. There was fear. And it was largely based on a particular hypothesis about what we were facing. They decided this was an extraterrestrial being that flew here in these little metal craft. And apparently they don't like static electricity. So people were analyzing this phenomena with the idea of a physical body being transported across unimaginable space and time in a little tiny thing, and we can capture a little tiny thing and then kill people with it. So this is the operating hypothesis of every scientist who tried to analyze the phenomena, that we just need to track the thingy, and then we can figure out what the thingy is. This is called, now to distinguish it from other hypotheses, the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And people were coming up with this hypothesis to try to figure out something called the Fermi paradox. And this is, of course, Enrico Fermi. He's probably one of the most important scientists of the 20th century, definitely the most important nuclear scientist, and constructed the first nuclear reactor. And while he was working at Los Alamos, he was going to lunch with some of his pals, and they were discussing the Drake equation. The Drake equation, of course, you're familiar with. If you calculate this, and then you get these variables, and continue through this, then you end up with there should be varmints everywhere, that there should be creatures all over the galaxy. We should be lousy infested with other beings. So he asked on his way to lunch at Los Alamos. Well, actually, by way of background, this is his Los Alamos security picture. He invented the first nuclear reactor, worked on the first atomic bomb, and when they discovered element 100 on the periodic table, he got his own element, number 100, fermium. So Fermi, he's a Fellini-esque fellow, dapper. They're going to lunch. They're discussing, well, where are the aliens? And so he says, well, where is everybody? And this became the Fermi paradox. It's the idea that although there's this statistical probability of alien life being everywhere, that there is no evidence for it. There is no artifact, there is no contact. So for this, he gets his own paradox. And so people have been trying to answer this paradox in different ways, that if there's high statistical likelihood and no observable evidence, is it because we are completely alone, that we're a cosmic fluke, that all that we see before us right now is the best the universe can do, and this is it? Another answer is that God wants it this way, so shut up. Another possible answer is the prime directive, or the zoo hypothesis. This is, of course, them discussing a violation of the prime directive. The idea that the aliens know we're here, but we're too primitive, they're going to leave us alone, kind of like a rare, disgusting lichen. And then another answer to this paradox is that other civilizations exist, and we can't directly perceive evidence of it because they're totally fucking with us. And some people saw this possibility, and rather than fear, they felt joy. A totally different perspective on the idea of otherworldly communication, that yes, it is happening, it makes no sense, and that's great. So this began with, in the modern era, with this guy. He was a religious moonshiner, amateur astronomer. This is George Adamski. And he hung out with Venusians. And one thing you'll notice about Venusians as we look at them is that they're usually pretty hot, which makes sense, right? Because it's the goddess of love. The surface is hot enough to melt lead, so they're usually pretty good looking. So this is a sketch of Adamski's Venusian pal, who actually, this is supposed to be a male Venusian, but it looks a little bit like Janine Garofalo. And Adamski went on the UFO talk show circuit, which was basically this guy, Long John Nebel. Call him Long John. And in the 50s, he was the guy to go to if you'd been contacted by aliens. And Adamski claimed that he met the space people near San Diego and later went to lunch with them in downtown Los Angeles. And this is their flying bucket. This description of a UFO also became an iconic emblem for UFO contact throughout the 20th century, just because he got there first. Network effect. So this is another of the early contactees, Orfeo Angelucci, who was a mechanic at a Burbank aerospace plant. And he seemed like a straightforward guy, another sort of casual Italian fellow who just said, yeah, I met some Venusians down by the LA River. What? Another guy at that same Burbank aerospace plant was George Van Tassel. And here we see him having a midlife crisis. What happened was, George was actually driving out in the desert in the early 40s during the war, taking a break from aerospacery, and he met this guy. This is Frank Kritzer, actual picture, German prospector. And Van Tassel and his uncle met Kritzer where his car was broken down, gave him some money, gave him some food, helped him out. And so in return, Kritzer told him about Giant Rock and promised to cut them in on his mining claim, which was apparently the world's largest boulder. So they're Kritzer. See you later. So Kritzer was a feisty fellow, and during World War II, he came under suspicion as a German spy, which may have been in part due to his radio hobby, or his extremely thick German accent, or his antisocial attitude, or his large stash of explosives that he had hidden under the largest boulder in the world. So in 1942, he was killed in a botched raid on his dwelling beneath Giant Rock, and he too was blown up under mysterious circumstances. Some say it was a mislaid tear gas canister, but no one really knows. So Giant Rock was now vacant. And so Van Tassel remembered this and moved his wife and three daughters from Los Angeles to the high desert near Yucca Valley. And with 2,600 acres that he leased from the government, he now had Giant Rock. This is Giant Rock. This is Giant Rock with a car on it. This is a Zardoz reference. So, sleeping outside one night near the Giant Rock, George was contacted by the space people. Again, hot. And he started having conventions under the tutelage of the Space Brothers, bringing all the contactees together. So here's Orfeo Angelucci, this is George Van Tassel, Frank Scully, another contactee, George Williamson. Now, Van was a little goofy, kind of a showman about the whole thing, so Adamski actually hated it, and
He only came out to Giant Rock once. He wanted to be taken more seriously. He actually flew in a bucket with Venusians, quit messing around. So George brought the message to the people, and the people came. So the saucer freaks all gathered for an annual saucer party. And this went on for decades, became very popular at some point. And also note the classic Adamski UFO, which even 30 years later was still the emblem of contact with the other. And so at some of these events, people arrive claiming to actually be Venusians. And so here we see a photo of the alleged Venusians, and they probably are, because you can see that they kind of look a little Italian, natty dressers, pretty good looking, which also makes us wonder about who else might be Venusians, and wondering about Venusian names. Now, in terms of the culture of this time, this is an actual Plan 9 culture. Now, everyone's completely familiar with the plot of Plan 9, so I don't need to go too deeply into it. But the idea is that some people, you've seen the movie, but these people were living the movie, where it was a fairly serious lifestyle, an alternative worldview tied to our mythologies about technology and progress. And I'll just review the plot briefly for those of you who may have forgotten, but the actual point of the movie is that the aliens are trying to contact humanity because the humans won't acknowledge that they're there. So they fly over Washington, and they sit there dangling their ship on a little string, and everyone's shooting at them, and they fly away, and then the government pretends it didn't happen. So the reason it's Plan 9 is because the other 8 plans didn't work. The aliens tried everything. That they fly around, they land, they say hello, they talk on the radio, and no one will pay them any attention. So eventually they're like, fuck it, we'll raise the dead. Like, we're trying to talk to you. The reason that they actually involved the corpses of dead people and the occult were that they had no other options to communicate with humans. Humans could not get it. This is a desperate effort to speak by using occult and sexual and sex and death symbolism to try and explain the fact that they are here. It's a very prescient film. I think it deserves a lot more scholarly study. So this actually ties fairly closely to the hybrid alien mythology, which grew out of these times. And it became another way that people tried to make some sense of this contact. And this evolved into a mythology, which is sort of the background running theme of the X-Files, that there's a hybrid program that's being run by government and aliens working together, tied to the Majestic 12 mythology. Oh, totally other talk. Also cattle mutilations, which have made their way into culture and have been normalized to the degree that they are used to sell camcorders. But the idea was, or one of the hypotheses around the cattle mutilations, is that alien government agencies working in tandem were stealing cow blood to feed the hybrid fetuses, which are living beneath Area 51. And sexual abductions are an inherent part of this mythos, that the aliens are trying to bang humans to try and make some sort of weird hybrid and weave their way into our culture. This was actually a jazz singer who tried to use this for her career for a while. She said she had sex with a 6-foot alien. It seems like if you're going to have sex with an alien, just make him sort of normal height. It's a little boring. Her sight's gone now. But this guy had all kinds of strange, intimate experiences with aliens. This is Whitley Strieber. And he wrote movies like The Hunger and Wolfen, where there's this other race that is preying upon humans and manipulating them to their desires. Later he said that he'd actually experienced an entire lifetime of strange contact and probing, and he did fairly well with that entire mythology. So what about Antonio? How did Mr. Villas-Boas do after being dumped off the spaceship, after being used? He became a lawyer, lived a fairly normal, successful life, and never recanted his tale of sexy contact. But at a certain point in the 60s, the people who talked about contact with alien and speaking with the Space Brothers, this peaceful race that were going to lead us to a utopia, shifted to abductees, and it mainly changed with Betty Hill. In 1961, she was abducted in rural New Hampshire while driving home from her honeymoon. And actually, an interesting detail, her purple abduction dress was stained in the incident and became the object of many scientific and medical probes. So Betty Hill is considered the marker shifting this from contact to abduction. And it's often called the Betty Hill case. But actually, it's the Betty and Barney Hill case. And Barney is sometimes left out of the story and sometimes cropped out of images that describe the incident. Mm. But in the early 60s, an interracial couple talking about being probed and manipulated by powerful others on the night of their honeymoon sort of has a lot of other sociopolitical subtext going on. So this is interesting. This is actually another story about their UFO experience. But if you compare it to the book release photo, this is Interrupted Journey, and they're trying to sell the book. Oh, man, it sucked. But then when they're talking about, oh, yeah, I don't know, don't go aliens. So there's, again, a certain degree of interpretation in terms of how people want to frame these encounters. Barney died in the early 70s, but Betty lived a long life, and she sort of didn't mind her role as sort of the godmother of this abduction phenomena. And at some point, somebody made her a ceramic bust of what she described the aliens who abducted her look like, and she named it Junior. And she went to all the science fiction and UFO conventions with it. This guy calls himself Mr. UFO. You can tell by the hair. So there she is with Junior. Let's get a close-up on Junior. You know, sometimes it's a little suggestive, but sometimes a phallic ceramic alien dildo head is just a ceramic phallic alien dildo head. Now, another guy who was a reluctant contactee, he wasn't abducted, but he didn't want the experience, and it wasn't particularly sexy. This was Joe Simonton. He was a farmer in the Midwest. And again, this was in 1961, so the same year, but he says that some dapper men flew down into his front yard. Actually, the ship landed, the door opened, there were dapper men inside. They were in black suits, nicely cut, red stripe down the side. Perhaps they were sort of Italian, maybe Venusian. "Ciao," said the men. "Do you have any fresh water?" So he went to his well, got the fresh water, brought it back to him, and Jacques Vallée points out this is actually part of common fairy tale stories, that the fairies need fresh water for some reason. So he brings them... He brings them fresh water, and then he notices they're cooking on a little grill that they have in their spaceship, because that's what aliens do when they're flying around. They're just cooking a little brunch. And so he says, "May I have what you're cooking?" And so they give him two pancakes. And so he does what any stolid Midwestern farmer would do. He goes straight. Hmm. Oh, you wish. No, this is a dirty story. he doesn't eat the pancake. Sensible. He takes it straight to the Air Force. And they chemically analyze it, come back to him with all the ingredients. What you have here is buckwheat flour, some baking soda. This seems to be a buckwheat pancake. So Joe Simonton ends up spending the rest of his life staring at a goddamn pancake like a fucking idiot. He didn't want to do this. He regretted it. And he said several times, like, if he had a choice and realized what was going to happen, he would never have told anyone that two guys flew down to his yard and gave him a pancake. Now, another thing that Jacques Vallée points out about this incident is when they go through the chemical list of the ingredients in the pancake, it's a normal pancake, except that there's no salt. Which, again, in fairy tales, you use salt to keep the fairies out of your house and protect your child from being abducted by fairies. So it's just a completely normal pancake, except it just happens to not have any salt. Now, when people are trying to examine these experiences and try to figure out what's going on with them, there's another problem, which is that people actually are screwing around with people's heads. And the best example in terms of documentation for this is MKUltra, which is, of course, a performance art project conducted by our government. Totally real, an actual for real mind control program, which was only discovered because one box of documents out of 20 didn't get shredded, and it was found in the 70s about something that was done in the 50s, in the 40s. So they describe trying different drugs, experimenting with different situations to screw with people's heads. That was the object of their experimentation. One thing that was actually described and read into the congressional record was a technique where they put a barbiturate IV into one arm and amphetamine IV into the other arm, and then do the barbiturate IV till the person starts to pass out, then hit them with amphetamines, then repeat the process till they start babbling insanely, and maybe they'll get some great answers out of them. So they documented this. Like, yeah, this is a perfectly valid technique. One of the other things that they did was they created brothels in San Francisco and New York, and these are the only the ones that were that the documentation survived, where they actually described the decor, the flocked wallpaper, the weird one-way mirror. And so in Operation Midnight Climax, the CIA found people off the street, brought them to the brothel, and they picked these people based on who they thought no one would believe if they told their story again. So then they dosed them with, you know, LSD or whatever, and then tried to freak them out, and then tape their responses. And then people would review these responses to try and get some sort of useful information out of them and how we can use these interrogation techniques in the future. So we know that actual humans are messing around with people's heads deliberately, that they're trying to fuck around with people, that they are actually trying to confuse people to the degree that they can't actually figure out what happened. So Jacques Vallée wrote several books about the UFO phenomena, and by the late 60s and 70s, he was writing about specifically the acts of deception that were occurring among UFO organizations. This book was Messengers of Deception, where he examined some of these groups and their strange ties to national intelligence agencies. And one of them in particular that he was concerned about was the Two, who sometimes called themselves Bo and Peep. And so he saw them in the 50s touring college campuses. And this is Marshall Applewhite and Bonnie Nettles. They actually met in 1972 when Applewhite was lost his job for having sex with a male student at the school he worked at. So he was in the hospital after trying to kill himself and hoping to cure his homosexuality. Bonnie, his nurse at the psychiatric hospital, believed that the both of them were alien beings sent here to save the entire planet. So you know this isn't going to end well. 3 years later, they were touring college campuses as the Two, and they were trying to recruit followers. They didn't get very many, but Vallée was just concerned at the fact that these people were getting a lot of attention in any case. So he wrote about them in 1975. They changed their name in 1975 to Total Overcomers Anonymous. Eventually, they changed their name to Heaven's Gate. And in 1985, Bonnie died of cancer, and at some point in the intervening years, Applewhite had himself surgically castrated, and then in 1997, things kind of went off the rails. 39 people killed themselves trying to hitch a ride home on the UFO behind Hale-Bopp, and 8 of the males were also surgically castrated. So that was one perspective on trying to deal with alien contact, and then one view on how that sexual relationship worked. A completely different view is the Raelians, because they're actually still an extant organization. They were founded by a pop idol, Claude Vauquelin. He was a teen idol in France, also a race car driver, also the editor of a race car magazine, so he got to test drive sports cars. And in 1973, he was contacted by some sort of extraterrestrial being, and then his magazine changed focus. So, again, Jacques Vallée was particularly concerned about this person having been sort of a minor pop idol and being this popular cultural figure with access to publications, and suddenly deciding he had a message that could not be questioned from some outside intelligence, and people had to follow what he believed. So he saw this as manipulation by some unseen agency, and it was unclear who was manipulating and what the facts behind the case were. And he was especially concerned when Claude, now called Rael, started sporting a swastika Star of David bling bling. So Claude had changed. He had a message for the world. And the message, they took me to their planet. And he developed this message to the point where it's now an organization today which sells itself based primarily on having skeevy sex with all the followers of the organization, sort of like a polyamorous Star Trek. Now, this is a connection we have to go through kind of quickly. I just noticed that in one Star Trek episode, The Wink of an Eye, a group of aliens are looking for mates because their males have become sterile, and they've also experienced a weird time acceleration so that humans can't perceive them even though they're right next to them. The leader of the aliens, of course, wants Kirk as her own private consort, and her male mate, who was now sterile and, of course, jealous of Kirk, was named Rael. There's no real point to that, really. But it's interesting that these connections seem to occur where someone is trying to think of an interesting fictional name for an organization built around space travel and alien communication. So the Raelians eventually changed their logo and made it resemble that of the planned community of Valencia in Southern California. And they, here he is with a real, actual spaceship. And he's still communicating his message to the young people. They're not a very large organization, but they got a lot of press a few years ago with Clone Aid, where they said they'd actually managed to clone humans. So what about Dianetics? This one actually succeeded quite well. It became a global religion evolving out of the sci-fi pulp magazine, spanning the Earth. It has lived long. It has prospered. They also have a race car. L. Ron was now the head of a globe-spanning religion with millions of dollars at his disposal, leading people ever farther over the bridge to total freedom. but eventually the tax investigators and the heavy diet of drugs got to him, and he fled on a yacht and increasingly circled the world, only stopping to pick up more drugs and young people and occasionally sort of disgorging a new religious revelation, which interestingly is the same lifestyle being led at the same time by William S. Burroughs. They're both sort of in North Africa at the same time, slathered in mugwumpism and nubile children. So also writing nonlinear texts that don't seem to make any sense at all. And in 1969, L. Ron had a winner while he was berthed at Las Palmas, where he describes the actual for real 70 million years ago existence on the planet Tegeac, which Earth was known as. And this is what you get when you reach operating Thetan level 3 of Dianetics. You get this document. And at that point, you read this about explaining how you feel bad because the nuclear bombs killed the previous residents of Tegeac, and now they've infested you like fleas, and so that's why you paid $120,000 for auditing. It sort of looks like this, an artist rendering. So at that point, people either snap or believe. So it worked out pretty well. But it was still kind of a hard-knock life on the yacht, coming up with ever freakier, more expensive revelations of alien truth. But he kept at it. He's a hard-working man. Now, according to his son, he based all this on Crowleyan magic, and which was based on the idea of changing perception of the physical world. So it was a system overtly based on pattern manipulation and generation. And one of the patterns that Crowley was particularly proud of was the unicursal hexagram. The unicursal hexagram? Yes, the unicursal hexagram is a six-pointed star that can be drawn with a single stroke, either with a pen or your magical athame. So Crowley was particularly proud of it because when combined with the Marian rose and its saucy symbolism, then he considered it as sort of his own personal sigil. And the idea was that this connection of points was itself an act of expressing will over the world, that because you could connect something to something else, the symbolic connection gave you power over the physical universe. And I bring this up in this context because it's another example of a strange connection where 210 was Jack Parsons' magical number, which he used to sort of identify himself, signing his magical practice. And the Free Witch now runs through Pasadena. Right between the mansion and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is the 210 freeway. Just no reason, just pointing that out. Another thing, this doesn't really relate to anything, but Barbara Bush is the illegitimate daughter of Aleister Crowley. It's on the internet. It's true. You can look it up. I just point these connections out there so you can consider them. This is her alleged father. This is Aleister Crowley. I don't know. You decide. Evidence is out there. And this is definitely off topic, but I just like it for the facial expressions because that this is Jeb Bush on prednisone for his ulcerative colitis. He's on booze and coke, downers, antipsychotics, astrology. And then she, Columbia, is actually very heavily involved with substance abuse issues. No reason. Just because it's what she's into. Why do you ask? Another interesting connection is that what is now Los Alamos Labs, the site of the Manhattan Project, origin of the atomic bomb, before the war it was Los Alamos Ranch School. And one guy who was sent to Los Alamos Ranch School as a teenager was William S. Burroughs, and he had his first sexual experience in the buildings that later became the place where the atomic bomb was invented. Again, just something to think about, just throwing that out there. We have to ask, how would a non-human entity communicate with the primates of Earth? Would they use radio signals or poorly built spaceships or highly charged symbolic communication? And would we even be able to perceive such symbolic communication, much less understand it? So with humans deliberately fucking with us, would we even be able to interpret this information at all? And what about Jacques Vallée? How does he deal with this whole situation? Now that sci-fi has become real, and we know there are multiple forces deliberately messing with our heads, how does he deal with trying to comprehend non-human communication? Well, his last book, the third part of a trilogy about UFO contact, was published in 1992, Revelations. And he describes contactee phenomena as deeply entangled with human deception and actual intelligence agencies trying to manipulate society for some unclear purpose. And he suggested it's actually now impossible to arrive at any objective facts about these phenomena because the manipulation of the belief systems are so intense and so much inextricably a part of whatever is happening, you can't get to the bottom of it. So today, Jacques Vallée no longer writes about UFOs. He is a successful venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. And his last book, written in 2001, The Four Elements of Financial Alchemy. If you're like me, you're probably wondering, what does all this have to do with Tron? And by way of explanation, for about a decade I've been using Tron as a heuristic interpretive device to try and understand the underlying ideology of an increasingly cybernetic society. I mean, obviously, right? It's old news. So I'm trying to expand this into a broader cultural tool, something I'm calling right now the genetic algorithm of Jeff Bridges, where in Tron he occupies a particular subject position, and in other iterations of the algorithm, he occupies different subject positions. So we can see in Tron where he is trying to hack into a corporation, and where in The Big Lebowski some new shit has come to light, whereas he's trying to get to the evidence man in Tron. So there's sort of a different iteration of the same algorithmic code. It's also worth noting that he played an alien who reanimated the body of a woman's dead husband, just like in Plan 9. And in this film, where he was also another corporate figure, as he was in Tron, where he was released back into the world after being digitized, but now he's the CEO of an InfoCapital empire, and he looks benevolent, but actually becomes the force that releases the cybernetic program into society, as opposed to just creating an SUV that can destroy people with his will. And in The Big Lebowski, the dude abides. So we see this algorithm running in different ways, but actually, it's completely nonsensical. I'm sorry. And I'm still working on it. So we're a little short on time, so I think I'm going to just end this with a close reading of the term WTF. Or as it's usually stated, WTF. For example, now, let's break this down. So we have what, which is a basic epistemological inquiry, and the, a singular article. So we're making a specific inquiry into what is occurring. And the recent past, this would have been followed by the hell. It made grammatical sense, kind of like the Batman. And it boils down to a legitimate question. Lo, what hell-spawned oddity is here before me? But it's not the hell, it's the fuck. Or rather, the fuck. And this is usually interpreted as an intensifier of the question, but it can also be read as an intensifier of an incomprehensible situation. So, before me, this confounds me to the extent which I must verily cry, fuck. So, this is a common interpretation, but I propose an alternative grammar in which it's actually an appositional phrase in which the two parts are reinforcing repetitions of the same subject. So, punctuate to emphasize, what the fuck, what? The fuck? So in this appositional interpretation, the fuck represents a query with additional information. It relates to the generative paranoia underlying epistemology itself and the nature of any inquiry to involve being fucked with. And it also invokes the transfer and hybridization of information, which is when its most basic biological form is fucking. So we have apposition is also a medical term describing two tissues which are surgically united. And then I got that far, and I was like, you know what, fuck it. This is bullshit. This is what they want you to do. They want you to get tangled up in the unbelievable nature of a situation and just paralyze yourself with self-reflexive analysis. And this isn't how Shatner would have wanted to end this talk. So I'm at an hour now, so I think I should probably end it there.
There's just one question. What's hiding in your suitcase?
Well, instead of questions, I have a dramatic reading. So if we had time, I would have done that.
I tell you what. How long would it take?
It's about 6 minutes.
Do it, please.
Okay. All right. So instead of taking your questions, I will attempt to answer your questions in the best way that I was able to come up with. The dramatic reading from a letter that L. Ron Hubbard wrote to the Attorney General, and he actually addressed it the Attorney General, comma, Washington, D.C. That's a little much. So let's just take a few minutes. There we go. All right. So addressed to the Attorney General, this was 1951, and this is the last two pages of a 7-page letter read verbatim.
I only know these things while I let them, unsuspected, cluster around me. These people stopped Dianetics in its tracks. With them gone, we can run an organization. But once ejected, they began, evidently through Sarah, these remarkable attacks. I believe this woman to be under heavy duress. She was born into a criminal atmosphere. Her father, a criminal record. Her half-sister, an inmate of an insane asylum. She was part of a free love colony in Pasadena. She has attached herself to Jack Parsons, the rocket scientist. During the war, and when she left him, he was a wreck. Further, through Parsons, she was strangely intimate with many scientists of Los Alamos. I did not know or realize these things until I myself investigated the matter. She may have a record. My plea is simply this. Security in which science can work. Why do these people remain at large, free of our press, destructive of our efforts? I have been developing, in spite of these interbulences, data of some value, as this rudimentary pamphlet provides. Dianetics and the Foundation, potent forces, almost fell into complete communist control, or the control of ex-communists, whatever. I cannot fight the battle of communists versus the world with only opponent or threat. Certainly someone else must at least be fatally interested. My life has been in danger. My work has suffered. My life is still in danger. My reputation is almost ruined, so these vermin communists, or ex-communists, whatever they are, can take over a piece of society and a technology. If Russia possessed the notes I have on psychological warfare, she would be that much more potent. Further, I do not believe these people meant to destroy Dianetics, but to drive it underground. They helped me with radio programs which did not get played, by pamphlets which did not give the whole story, and by advice which attempted to knock every loyal American out of Dianetics. What can one do in the face of this? When will we have a roundup? Please compare these notes to your files. I am certain you will find these names repeated there, connected with communist activities. Perhaps in your criminal files or on the police blotter of Pasadena. You will find Sarah Elizabeth Northrup, about age 26, born April 8th, 19-something, about 5'9". Blonde brown hair, slender. My own investigation seems to indicate that possibility. Her residence from 1942 to 1945 was
1003 South Orange Grove, Pasadena.
I have no revenge motive, nor am I trying to angle this broader than it is. I believe she is under duress, that they have something on her, and I believe that under a grilling, she would talk and turn state's evidence.
All these matters are, of course, confidential.
I do not wish them to be published in any way.
I am not trying to regain a reputation by blaming communism, but I'm trying hard to understand.
How is it that these persons, all solidly ex-affiliated or currently affiliated as a group, work in such close partnership against a technology that they know would hurt communism, and yet they remain at liberty?
I'm applying to the Department of Defense for permit to deliver my work on psychological warfare. I hope this new foundation can operate, but frankly, from what has happened, I'm not certain I will live through this.
If I do not know that I only have these enemies in the entire world, may I respectfully request, sir, assistance in rendering America a trifle safer for new science. I wish I could ask you to extend that clause in the charter of the FBI about persons in distress. Sincerely, L. Ron Hubbard.